Today on Against the Grain. In the decades leading up to the Civil War, enslaved people who traveled to freedom on foot did so mainly from southern states that bordered free states. But those in the Deep South didn't have that option, and they often made their journey north by ship from the South's long coastline with the help of free blacks as well as white sailors. Historian Marcus Rediker sets the record straight, illuminating the ways that the culture of port cities and of free black communities helped the formerly enslaved make their way to freedom. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. When we picture the Underground Railroad, along with enslaved people being sheltered in houses en route to freedom, we might want to picture boats on the river waves of the Carolinas, ships sailing from southern ports like Savannah, Georgia, and the harbors of Boston and New York. Marcus Rediker is professor of early American and Atlantic history at the University of Pittsburgh. In Freedom Ship, The Uncharted History of Escaping Slavery by Sea, he argues that accounts of American slavery and freedom have omitted a crucial route that enslaved people used to emancipate themselves. Rediker is the author of many books, including The Slave Ship and The Amistad Rebellion, and he's co-author of The Many-Headed Hydra. Marcus, when we think of escape from slavery, we picture people fleeing north over land in long and perilous journeys by foot. Of the people who successfully left slavery behind permanently through the networks of the Underground Railroad, do we have any sense of the magnitude of those who fled not by land but by sea?
We do. The Underground Railroad, which is a very powerful idea, which encapsulates resistance of all kinds, is a metaphor. And metaphors organize your understanding by emphasizing certain things but excluding other things. And I always like to tell people that of the thousands of people who escaped slavery, very few of them did it underground and very few of them did it by railroad. So this is a misleading metaphor in many ways. Scholars for many years now have tried to determine how many people actually escaped permanently. It's not easy to do because the ideal escape would leave no documentation. So the range of possibilities is quite broad. 50,000 up to, say, 100,000 people escaped permanently. This would be over the probably the full 19th century up to the outbreak of Civil War. Of that 50 to 100,000, I have determined by various means that somewhere between 15 and 20,000, that's a very conservative estimate, escaped by sea in one way or another. So whether it's 50,000 or 100,000, a very significant number of people escaped by going down to the water, to the docks, the waterfront, and getting on board a ship and sailing to a northern state where slavery had already been abolished.
Can you give us an idea of some of the stories of how people made that escape? What routes did they take? Where did they leave from? You know, with the Underground Railroad by land, many of the people fleeing were fleeing states to neighboring states, which were free states. Obviously, for many people who were enslaved, that actually wasn't an option. How did they make their way north by waterways?
Well, let me just mention that I studied 9 port cities in this book. Southern ports, Savannah, Georgia, Charleston, South Carolina, Wilmington, North Carolina, Norfolk, and Baltimore as ports of exit from the South, and then Philadelphia, New York, New Bedford, and Boston as ports of arrival. So what's also important to understand is that there was a structure to escape in the sense that This was all made possible by the fact that thousands of Northern-owned vessels were sailed from those northern ports I just mentioned to those southern ports I just mentioned every year, and every vessel that left a southern port to return to its northern base represented a potential line of escape. If, for example, you lived in Savannah, Georgia, or Charleston, South Carolina, it's nearly impossible to imagine escaping over land. You would have to go hundreds and hundreds, and in some cases thousands of miles, in a situation where almost every white person was deputized to arrest you at under any suspicion. So getting on board a ship in those deeper South states was a much more likely way to get to freedom. Now, people did this in all kinds of different ways. Some people used small craft, small boats that they used in their normal working lives, and would paddle, row, or sail those small vessels to a northern port. But many more of them got on board these larger northern vessels, frequently by developing a relationship with a sailor, a dock worker, or a market woman who could get that fugitive, that would-be fugitive, on board the ship safely and help that person to stow away, to hide, and then to make the full voyage and emerge at the other end of it in what they called a free country. I'll just give one example of the way this worked. There was a man in Charleston, South Carolina named Jim Matthews, who was from inland in South Carolina. He didn't know very much about the ways of the waterfront, but he ran away. He got to Charleston, and he decided he'd try to get a job as a dock worker. And he did manage to get taken into a gang of dock workers. He managed to get on board a ship. He managed to meet a steward, a ship's cook. We don't know whether the cook was black or white, but this person took an interest in Jim, helped him to hide away, brought him food during the course of the voyage, and Jim made his way to the north and eventually became a free man living out his days in Hallowell, Maine. So this is a fairly common example of how it worked. But here's the point. You had to have connections. You know, we have this myth that running away was the act of a rugged individualist. Well, it certainly took individual skill and knowledge and everything else, but you had to have help. You had to know who could help you along the way in this very dangerous journey.
What role did free blacks play in helping enslaved people make it to freedom? Free blacks who might have been on northern ships, or once people got to the ports in the north?
I would say, Sasha, that the free black communities in the South and in the North, and the free black sailors who sailed on a lot of these vessels into southern ports, played probably the most important role of all, in many ways even more important than the abolitionists. Of course, many of the people in the free black community were abolitionists, but these were the people who made it possible to get on the ship in the first place, and frequently to get off it in a new place. In both the South and the North, a great many free black people worked on the waterfront. These waterfront workers were in a strategic position to help someone find the way aboard a ship. But even before that, in the South, these free black communities would frequently harbor and shelter and hide a fugitive before that person ever got on board a ship. So they play that kind of role too. One thing I say in the book is that the free black community of Norfolk, Virginia was an unbelievably well-organized place for fugitives. They had a care network that was very extensive, and it was tremendously successful. I would say that Norfolk was kind of the epicenter of escape in the South. If you could get to Norfolk one way or another, your likelihood of getting from there to freedom was much, much greater. when vessels harboring fugitives arrived in northern ports, they came to the waterfront. And among the first people they would see would be black dock workers. So these people would work with the sailors on board the ship to work it out so that they could enter the home of a free black person. Frequently, they lived near the waterfront, so that was convenient. So on the receiving end, the free black community was also extremely important. On the exiting end and on the arrival end, free black communities are playing an extraordinarily important role.
What role did white sailors play in helping fugitives escape slavery?
White sailors played a very important role. And I must say, there is a huge body of evidence on this point. We know, for example, that the radical black abolitionist David Walker, based in Boston, who wrote a very incendiary pamphlet called David Walker's Appeal, which basically encouraged the enslaved people of America to rise up and follow the example of the Haitian Revolution. Walker circulated his pamphlet in the South by using both black and white sailors. And we know this because some of the white sailors got arrested for doing it. What he would do, and this was very clever, Walker was a slop seller, which basically meant that he specialized in selling clothes to sailors. And what he would sometimes do is create a secret compartment in a jacket and sew into that several copies of the pamphlet so that it could be very easily smuggled ashore. But white sailors were a very significant part of this, and one of the themes that runs throughout the book is that they played a very significant role at great risk to themselves. Some of the people who helped David Walker, for example, went to jail for it. Considerable sentences. So this is a matter of the waterfront and of the solidarities of the waterfront.
Can you tell us about the culture, first of the southern ports, from which many enslaved folks were able to escape? What kind of culture did these places have that made them quite distinct from other parts of the South?
Well, southern ports were like ports everywhere else. They were big, they were chaotic, they were filled with people of many different races and ethnicities. One of the things that I've spent my life as a scholar exploring is the historical role of the motley crew, the multi-ethnic group of workers in port cities, on ships, who occupy this extraordinarily important position in the division of labor. Now, the northern ports and the southern ports did differ because you have vastly more enslaved workers in the south, but you basically have this more or less the same division of labor. You have dock workers, you have sailors, you have different maritime specialists or craftsmen. You'll find these in the south. The problem for southern rulers, the southern ruling class, was how to regulate the cooperation of people who routinely worked together on the waterfront to prevent them from doing things that they were not supposed to do. In other words, these rulers, these merchants, these plantation owners needed the motley crew to cooperate to move their cargo so that capital could accumulate. This is perfectly obvious. But what they didn't want to happen was that sailors and dock workers and fugitives would use that cooperation to develop projects of their own. And this, of course, is exactly what they did. But the waterfront is very well known as being a sort of rough and rugged and kind of hyper-masculine culture. Fistfights, lots of rowdy music, people working, you know, very hard, full of beggars, many of them former sailors who had been maimed in the course of their work, all kinds of people coming together in ways that really could not easily be regulated by the authorities of the port city.
I would like to ask you more in a moment about the ways that those in positions of power responded. But I'd like to ask you about that culture, which you just touched on. You know, sailors and port workers have a very long history of radicalism, which you have traced in your work on both sides of the Atlantic. We can bring that through the 20th century into the present. Why do you think there is that deep and kind of long-standing history of maritime radicalism that has shaped port culture? Is it simply that, you know, you have this wide mix of people from different backgrounds? You mentioned that in many ways, ports and people at sea are harder to govern by those in power. Is there something else as well? How do you understand it? Because it's a thread that we can see going over centuries.
That's right. There is an Atlantic maritime radical tradition. And I do see these escapes by sea as being a very important chapter in it. There are many things that go into making this kind of waterfront solidarity. But I think the most important one at sea and on the docks is that this is a really, these are really dangerous lines of work. Sailors and dock workers depend on each other in ways that many other workers do not. And if you look at this in a comparative perspective, sailors are very much like miners, for example, who work underground in very dangerous conditions. They depend on each other for their lives. So there is a very interesting quality here of cooperation and solidarity for the sake of mutual survival. So that's one very significant part of it. And I think in many ways, that's the key. But there also is this element of the extreme mixture of peoples. You know, Herman Melville once said, you know, nation states at sea, he said the idea is almost ridiculous because the people there are so motley, they're so multicultural, they're from all over the place. Down with your nation, says Melville. And I think this bred a different sort of attitude to your fellow workers, for one thing, but also a different attitude to political power and where it comes from and what it should be. So I come back again and again to the labor history of all this, and the fact that there are these bonds of labor which inform most everything people do on the ship once they come ashore and as they develop these projects of freedom on their own.
Scholar of history from below, Marcus Redeker, is my guest. We're discussing his book, Freedom Ship, The Uncharted History of Escaping Slavery by Sea. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So can you give us an idea of some of the stories of people who managed to free themselves and with the aid of others escape slavery by ship, some of them over great distances? Some of these tales have been preserved in different ways. Can you give us a sense of the ways people escaped and the kind of aid that they got en route?
One of the most famous maritime fugitives is a woman named Harriet Jacobs of Edenton, North Carolina. As many of your listeners will know, Harriet Jacobs wrote an account of her life, Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, in which she detailed in really grisly fashion the specific horrors that women experienced under slavery. She was, her so-called owner, was a man who was a sexual predator, and she spent from the age of 14 on trying to escape his clutches. She was unbelievably enterprising and brilliant in doing it. She lived in, as I say, Edenton, North Carolina. An escape over land from there in North Carolina would have been very, very difficult. So she decided that she would escape by sea. And the key to this is that all three of her uncles were sailors. And her oldest uncle, Uncle Joseph, was himself a maritime escapee. He escaped three different times. The third time he finally got away. He sailed somewhere to the Mediterranean. And she had another uncle, Mark, and an uncle, Stephen, both of whom lived there, were based there in Edenton. Mark went back and forth from Edenton to New York on what was called a packet ship. But anyway, these uncles were the ones who made the arrangements and got her on board a ship which would carry her to freedom. So it was the maritime nature of her family which made this possible. And this goes down to the details of escape itself. When Harriet is finally ready to make a move, she waited for years to find a safe ship. Her aunt came to her with a set of sailor's clothing, male sailor's clothing, which she was going to dress up in. And she used charcoal to darken her face. Harriet was very light-skinned. So she was basically going to go to sea looking like a black sailor, because a sailor was the only person in Edenton who might not be known to you as one of your neighbors. So Harriet Jacobs goes to sea, dressed as a sailor, is hidden away aboard a vessel, and arrives actually in Philadelphia. And she then moves to New York. A little bit later, she begins the process of writing her life story. But the key to her life is that extraordinary maritime escape. And she details how this worked in very concrete language.
Of course, one of the best known fugitives from slavery was the crucial abolitionist Frederick Douglass. And in his case, maritime escape figures into his story, but it was something that initially he did not disclose or write about because he was concerned that that would endanger other people. I wonder if you could tell us about Frederick Douglass and what his escape tells us.
Yes, Frederick Douglass is probably the most important abolitionist of the 19th century, was an enslaved person in Maryland who escaped in 1838. But what is really the key in Douglass's life, and he himself says so very forthrightly, was that at a fairly early age, he was sent to live with a relative of his enslaver in Baltimore, and he worked on the waterfront, where he, as a young boy, encountered two Irish sailors who showed him a great deal of sympathy and told him that a better life awaited him in the North if he would just run away. Now, Douglass, as I say, was very young at the time. He was rightly suspicious. These people might have not, they might have been trying to trap him and capture him and sell him back to his enslaver. But he was too young at that point to do it anyway. He said, but that's the moment at which I resolved that I was going to run away. And he was going to do it by sea. He actually, in 1836, 2 years before he finally escaped, he did organize a plot involving himself and four other men, a couple of whom were his relatives, to row up the Chesapeake Bay. But that plot was given away by a snitch. He was captured. He thought he was going to be sent to the Deep South, where the possibility of escape would have been very, very small. But anyway, he somehow managed to avoid that fate, went back to work at the waterfront. He was a skilled caulker, as he used to put it. He said, I could walk the walk, and sailors did have a very specific walk, and I could talk the talk. He knew all of the nautical lingo. So when it's time to escape, he dresses up as a sailor. He asks a man named Stanley for his seaman's protection certificate. This was something given out by the U.S. government to keep American sailors from being pressed on board of British ships. So this is actually a very good form of identification. He dressed as a sailor, and then he actually got on a train. He didn't go immediately by ship, although he would go by ship in a later portion of his escape. So Frederick Douglass does successfully escape. He makes it to New York, where he meets a black sailor abolitionist named David Ruggles, who tells him that the place for him is New Bedford, Massachusetts, because that's a place where there's lots of maritime work. He noted Douglas's skill as a calker. And so off Douglas went, again, partly on land, partly by sea, to New Bedford, where his life as a free person would begin. And it's important to know that the free black community of New Bedford was extraordinarily militant. And one of the things that Douglas learned, most of them had been maritime escapees too, I might add. And Douglas said, these are people who will fight for your life if the slave catchers show up. So this was this maritime experience was very deep and very formative, and you might say the key to the way Douglas gained his freedom.
Well, you note, Marcus, that you know no escape was unaided or just by an individual, or if so, very few. But you also write about enslaved people escaping in groups, and I wonder if you could tell us about the daring action by 18 men in Virginia.
A very important development in the history of escape by sea occurred in the 1850s when a group of northern ship captains, who were themselves convinced abolitionists, began to make regular voyages to southern ports to trade, but with also the explicit goal of bringing enslaved people back to freedom. As it happened, several of these ship captains were all based in Wilmington, Delaware. So they would sail to the south. Many of them went to Norfolk, some to North Carolina, some to Virginia. And they would again make these fairly regular voyages so people would know who they were. And then it became possible for people to plan their escapes, that the next time Captain James Fountain, a Wilmington, showed up on shore, a group of us are going to try to meet with him and get on board. Now, it turns out there's also a transformation in the way the ship itself is organized, in that these captains and their carpenters begin to build secret compartments in the hold of the ship that will serve as the means of getting to freedom. So there was one group coming out of Norfolk, I think they were 21, actually, 21 people who managed to get on board this ship. Then there was this extraordinary incident in which the mayor of Norfolk came on board, and that people had begun to spread a few rumors about Captain Fountain. And he starts chopping up the deck, looking for people hiding out in the hold below. So what Fountain did, he was a very brave man. He said, give me the axe and tell me where you want me to aim it. He just starts chopping up the deck ferociously, so much so that he scared the mayor and all the officials who were with him, and they ended up kind of retreating in this meek way. And then he carried those people on to the north, and they all gained their freedom. So this is a new development in this system of maritime escape in the 1850s, and a lot of people got away in this fashion.
Well, how much of that was organized locally, if one could put it that way, of that kind of assistance, and how much of it was being coordinated by the larger abolitionist movement, you know, whether black or white, trying to actively help people flee in such a way?
It's a very important question, Sasha, because our mythology about the Underground Railroad makes us think that all of its successes were the result of principled and even noble white abolitionists in the North. And there were some people like that, I should mention. But the important thing to understand is that the fugitives themselves and the free black communities and the dock workers and the market women and the sailors, they were the ones who took the risks. Everything had to be worked out on the front end, locally. And the abolitionists really had almost nothing to do with that. In fact, William Still, the black abolitionist who was the leader of the Vigilance Committee in Philadelphia, to which a lot of the fugitives were sent so that he could give them food and clothing and shelter and help them find jobs. He basically said, look, we don't have anything to do with it. What kind of arrangements people want to make in the South to get on board a ship, let them do it. and just, live up to the terms of the agreement. But that's not up to us. So the crucial thing is the fugitives are the ones who take the biggest risks. So they, I think, deserve pride of place in the way we think about this. But 90% of the Freedom Voyage is over by the time those formal abolitionists that we know about get involved. Now, I use the term abolitionist much more broadly. These black and white sailors were abolitionists. These dock workers were abolitionists. Enslaved people were abolitionists. For the longest time, abolitionist has been coded white. So these are people who are fighting the system of slavery. But it's very important to know that these abolitionist organizations don't really become involved until quite late in the process. Now, when they do get involved, they play a really important role. I don't want to diminish that in the least, because these vigilance committees in particular helped thousands of people in tandem with the free black communities. Sometimes people would bypass the vigilance committee and just go straight to someone, to a free black worker on the waterfront, to stay with that person in their home. But the key thing here is who is bearing the risk. And it's the fugitives and their helpers, the people who extend solidarity in the South and on board those ships. Those are the people who are taking the greatest risks.
Well, and then what does that tell us about the sentiments in the last decades before the Civil War against slavery from below amongst, ordinary people on the docks? One could imagine that the free black community did not need to be convinced of the horrors of slavery, but for those other sailors who might have helped out, who were not organized, who were doing this sort of on their own steam, what does it tell us about how people, at least along the ports, the kinds of sentiments that were appearing both south and north about slavery? Can we read off of that?
I think what we can see from that is that the cause of anti-slavery is growing. You see, you need to understand that sailors who themselves were quite oppressed in their work lives, treated fairly badly, paid relatively little, poor quality food, harsh discipline, they understood this idea of people feeling enslaved and oppressed. So I think sailors, a portion of them anyway, were drawn to the kind of liberationist discourse of anti-slavery. And then what's happening is that once you start to be successful in bringing significant numbers of people to the North, and once the abolitionists began to publish the life stories of some of these people who risk it all, who risk their lives, who risk the flesh on their back to make it to freedom, then the power of those escapes is generalized. So there's no question that the things that abolitionists are publishing about these escapes are broadening the movement on the waterfront and elsewhere. Now, a really crucial moment in all this comes in 1850 with the Fugitive Slave Act, in which the U.S. federal government puts all of its power behind the slave-owning South and guarantees the return of escapees to their place of escape. Okay? The federal government, thanks to the Compromise of 1850, is willing to put tremendous resources into sending people back into slavery once they've reached a northern port. And since Boston was the sort of center of abolitionism, these southern enslavers were very keen to have some test cases in Boston. They really wanted to put these Boston abolitionists in their place. So there are, one of the chapters of my book talks about seven very important incidents of maritime escape and local struggles around each one. Now, in these cases, there were several people were not successfully brought back into slavery, but two of the most important of the maritime escapees, Thomas Sims in 1851 and Anthony Burns in 1854 were returned to their place of origin. Sims went back to Savannah, Georgia, and Burns back to Richmond, Virginia, but it cost so much money to return them. In other words, simply to get these people from the authorities to the ship required hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of military workers to protect them from the ever-growing crowds that wanted to attack and rescue them. So that by the time you get to Anthony Burns, this is costing the federal government $1 million, $1.5 million in today's currency. And this is not a viable model for how to return people. But here's the key. The Fugitive Slave Act and the resistance that it engendered turned public opinion toward the abolitionists. And I think there may be a lesson there for today.
Marcus Roediger is my guest. We're discussing his book, Freedom Ship, The Uncharted History of Escaping Slavery by Sea. He's professor of early American and Atlantic history at the University of Pittsburgh. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you mentioned the Fugitive Slave Act, but obviously slaveholders, even prior to that, were determined to recapture the human beings that they held in bondage, considering a financial loss. How did they attempt to kidnap people back prior to the Fugitive Slave Act, and to what lengths did they go?
These maritime escapees were the source of tremendous friction between the North and the South, between northern governments and the federal government. There was just a constant sort of fight going on about this from the 1830s onward. I'll give an example. In New York, three black sailors took off from the city on a vessel, went to Chesapeake Bay in Virginia, where they met a black man and a slave man named Isaac, who came on board the ship to do some repairs. And they started telling him how he would do so much better as a skilled craftsman in the North. So they hid him away. Well, it turns out that he made it to New York, but his enslaver actually had an idea that he was on board that ship. So he sent a slave catcher to New York immediately, and they captured him and they brought him back. But the event wasn't over yet, because the governor of Virginia wanted those three black sailors returned by the government of New York to Virginia to stand trial for what they called slave stealing. This actually became an extraordinary national controversy, because the governor of New York, William Seward, refused to comply with the request. So what you've got is one event after another like this. And every time this happens, there is this kind of southern fury about the fact that the northern states will not return their so-called property to their rightful owners. So this becomes more and more and more explosive. And in some of these events, the South actually starts threatening to secede from the Union, because the federal government can't guarantee the law. They can't protect their property. So this becomes a really crucial issue. And it does show how these maritime escapees were affecting the national debate about slavery.
You mentioned the circumstances in Boston in response to the removal of people under the Fugitive Slave Act after 1850. How did other port cities, the people there, receive the mandates of the Fugitive Slave Act outside of Boston? Was there the same sort of resistance that you've detailed there?
Boston was by far the hottest spot of resistance. By the time Thomas Sims was taken out of his free existence in Boston and sent back, there are estimates that the crowd trying to prevent that may have reached 50,000. So this is a very large percentage of the population of Boston at that time. So you can kind of see how far-reaching these new abolitionist ideas are. The contrary case is New York, and it's a fascinating thing in itself because New York merchants who shipped a lot of the cotton from the South on their ships to New England cotton mills and to cotton mills outside Liverpool. These merchants did everything they could to make sure that every runaway was returned to the South to face punishment. So New York was a tough spot. And people like David Ruggles, who I mentioned earlier, would frequently tell people, you've got to get out of New York. The place is crawling with slave catchers. They're just all over the place. Now, Philadelphia was more like Boston, not quite as militant as Boston. And that's primarily because Philadelphia had this history of anti-slavery that went back to the 1730s, really, and that Quaker-led anti-slavery movement there had a real basis, a deep social basis, and considerable political power. So I have a Southern enslaver saying, if a runaway ever gets to Philadelphia, forget it. You'll never get them out of there. It was just too much sympathy. But what's maybe the most radical place for resistance to slavery was probably New Bedford, because of that very significant free black community that was willing to fight at the drop of a hat. I did learn, and I say in the book, that, I mean, hundreds upon hundreds of maritime escapees arrived in New Bedford, and not a single one of them was ever carried back.
You've just been describing the kind of level of solidarity and resistance that existed in differing northern cities. I wanted to ask you, though, through a different lens, how the successful flight of enslaved people to the north through the ports transformed those northern cities, port cities themselves, cities like New York, that people escaped to, especially in terms of the people who inhabited those cities and worked on the ports, on the docks.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that all these successful escapes meant was more formerly enslaved and now self-emancipated people working on the waterfront. So the experience of resistance was multiplied. And I think this is very important. Another important thing, which I would like to emphasize, this is what I'm saying here is the result of the work of a former PhD student of mine named Jesse Olsovsky, who basically argues that these escapees, not just by sea but by land, all of the escapees who come to the North and basically deal with this more radical kind of abolitionist organization, the Vigilance Committee, they're the ones who are educating the abolitionists about the nature of American slavery. The truth is that most abolitionists had never been to the South, had never actually seen slavery with their own eyes, and then suddenly here are these powerful vectors of knowledge showing up in the Vigilance Committee office in Philadelphia, sitting down with these other abolitionists and explaining what slavery is really like. You know, I'll just give you an example of a powerful example of how this could go. There's a story about one abolitionist interviewing an enslaved man and being somewhat skeptical about what he was saying because there were a few imposters. But this man could tell, this formerly enslaved man could tell that this person interviewing him just really wasn't believing him. He stood up, turned his back, dropped his shirt, and unveiled a mass of scar tissue to show the truth of what he had been saying. So, do you believe me now? Well, that was a pretty powerful piece of evidence. So here's the point. These people in motion, they are carriers of knowledge. And one of the things I say in the book is that escaping slavery by sea is an art. It's an art that requires that you know all kinds of things. So to carry that knowledge of slavery, and then to become a symbol of successful resistance to it, this has a galvanic effect in the North.
Marcus Rediker, as we start to wrap up, what would you say is the significance of broadening out our understanding of the Underground Railroad to encompass escapes by sea? I mean, obviously, there's the value of correcting the historical record, but do you think that there are further ramifications for how we understand that crucial and formative era of American history, which obviously absolutely shapes the society that we live in now?
The significance of this maritime system of escape is great, not only because it resulted in thousands of people gaining their freedom, it's important because it powered the abolitionist movement. It helped to expand the abolitionist movement. It contributed to the polarization that would lead to civil war and eventually emancipation. But how it did that is especially fascinating because these escapes by sea were part of what Frederick Douglass and William Still called invisible agency. In other words, what's really fascinating to me about this is that this had been going on for decades, and historians knew very little about it, but it was this constant pressure of resistance. I called it for the South, death by a thousand cuts. So that there's this will, this political will that's being demonstrated, manifested, acted on by these fugitives and the people that they're working with, and we just didn't know about it. So what this proves to me is that the struggle against slavery was much broader than we thought, deeper than we thought, more profound than we thought, and a lot of it happened on the sea. As you know, Sasha, for many years I've been writing against the land-based versions of history because they falsify the past. We think that history happens only on land or in nation states, but of course history always happens at sea. I talked about this at great length in my book, The Slave Ship. Race formation happens at sea. Class formation happens at sea. The struggle against slavery happens at sea. So I think by recovering this lost theater of resistance, what we're doing is showing that the power of the history from below was greater than we knew, greater than we thought, and that this can be an inspiration for us, in our own time, seeing how people fought against great odds. I mean, think about what these escapees were up against. A powerful slave system, probably the most powerful in the world. A ruling class that had tremendous political power in Congress and frequently the presidency. Up against all of this concentrated power, and they just kept fighting day after day. And to me, this is probably the most important thing about this story. It's all about resistance, tireless, endless resistance.
Let me end with this question. Obviously, our times are quite different than those times, but we are living through fugitive times ourselves with undocumented people trying to avoid capture by Trump's ICE agents who would deport them. Not to overdraw the parallels, but do you see any echoes from the past in this very tumultuous and horrible time that we're living in?
I do think it's a good and apt comparison. Both situations about the extraordinary expansion of federal power to be used against mobile and oppressed people. I think it's too early to say yet what forms of resistance will emerge in the current moment, although I do know that there are a great many community-based initiatives. I think this is probably very, very important that people protect their own local communities. But I think the key thing is to understand that what we're seeing today is a very old struggle. There has always been a struggle over mobility and who can go where. And the borders of the nation states are basically meant to keep poor people in place. I do think that the current moment is all about this. I think the border regimes everywhere around the world, especially in the global north, this is a very key question. And I think the struggles over mobility are some of the most important ones we can find today. The No Borders movement is a really significant one.
Marcus Redeker, always a pleasure having you on.
Thank you, Sasha. Always good to be with you.
Marcus Redeker is the author of Freedom Ship, The Uncharted History of Escaping Slavery by Sea. He's professor of early American and Atlantic history at the University of Pittsburgh, and his many other books include The Slave Ship, The Amistad Rebellion, and he's co-author of The Many-Headed Hydra. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.